This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled weekend. Are you making plans? Or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a trivial pursuit of untold stories of Louisiana history, an entertaining look at the world of finance, a walkthrough of a blighted Treme property that could soon be home to local artists, or a photo exhibit that reminds us of what we are thankful for this holiday season. We've got answers. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. At this time of year, we give thanks to the many blessings that are bestowed upon our families and our community. And in the 7 years post-Katrina, there are so many things we can be thankful for. Two photo exhibits at the UNO St. Claude Gallery take a look at positive changes in our environment here in New Orleans and surrounding communities post-Katrina, and in Haiti through the lens of youth photographers following the 2010 earthquake.
We were all trying to address this idea of moments in transition or places in transition, that feeling of what is perhaps in the presence as well as what something once was or what it might become.
That's Aria Martin, an artist in residence who teaches photography in the Department of Fine Arts at the University of New Orleans and co-organizer of the exhibits Adjust and Adapt by Southerly Gould and Haiti, the Riviere Froide Kid Camera Project, which was created by participants in the Summer 2012 Haiti program conducted by the nonprofit organization One Bird. Martin, a New Yorker, came to New Orleans a year after Hurricane Katrina to work on the New Orleans Kid Camera Project.
The New Orleans Kid Camera Project was initially created to address the emotional and psychological impacts of Katrina on kids returning to New Orleans. And so we were working with photography and writing and some other forms of newer technologies and video and stuff, helping kids kind of process and share their perspectives on their neighborhoods and their city.
Martin and fellow photographers took the project to the Riviere Froide region of Haiti, just outside Port-au-Prince, this past summer.
We wanted two things to happen. We wanted them to share their perspective on their community, what they saw around their community, things that they liked, things that they didn't like, things that they wanted to see improved upon, and things that they were proud of. So there was that aspect, and then they had a series of self-portraits, so how they want to present themselves, what they would want to look like, if they wanted to wear any special clothing, if they wanted to bring something from home that was important to them and take a photograph with it. So we talked about portraiture and we talked about basic ideas, elements of composition when we were walking around. So the images are both, and they did writing for it as well. So what we saw was in their community images, many of them took photographs of the sky or looking up, trees, the tops of buildings. Some are images of people on the street, but it was really interesting to see that as a kind of a running theme or a commonality that a lot of them were taking these kinds of photographs. And a lot of the writing had to do with nature, with the environment, how nature is beautiful. One girl wrote, "I like this photograph because I like trees and they're useful for the country. I would like to have more trees in the country and long life to Haiti's trees." There was a real concern, I think, for their environment. And I think being young people in Haiti now, they really have the opportunity to affect some of the changes and know that their voices are important.
Back home in New Orleans, Martin and fellow female photographers form the group Southerly Gould and have documented the South in transition post-Katrina in their exhibit, Adjust and Adapt.
Specifically, kind of the areas around New Orleans. I think the furthest is Aubrey Edwards went to Pointe-aux-Chenes, Montague and Borg, and Akasha Rabu is working at the John McDonough High School, kind of photographing adolescence, thinking about transitions in that way, and education. in New Orleans, and Lena Ritchie was photographing New Orleans East. And then I had a series that was photographing the lake on my way to work and back from UNO. So I would photograph it in the morning and then in the evening, kind of ritualizing the process of the snapshot. I was just using my camera on my phone and, you know, allowing myself to follow that impulse that we sometimes have to just pull the car over and take a picture.
If a picture paints 1,000 words, the combined exhibits Adjust and Adapt and Rivière Froide speak volumes to the resilience, hope, faith, and strength exhibited by people in the aftermath of a catastrophe. The works are on view this month and next at the UNO St. Claude Gallery, 2429 St. Claude Avenue, and is being held in conjunction with Photo NOLA, the annual photography conference held by New Orleans Photo Alliance. There will be a gallery talk on November 30th at 5:30 p.m. and a reception December 2nd at 6 p.m. Writer Shelby Tucker's debut novel, Client Service, is a satire inspired by a major mutual fund swindle of the 1960s. Client Service just hit print in the U.S., and Shelby Tucker will be in New Orleans at the Garden District Bookshop this evening starting at 5:30 to discuss and sign copies of the book. WWNO's Fred Kasten has more.
Shelby Tucker, who grew up in West Tennessee and on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, was a relatively late convert to the joys of reading.
By the time I was 17, I had read one book, The Life of Davy Crockett, and I'd given a book report on it every year. I mean, to me, it seemed that reading was a waste of time when you could be out playing football and basketball and so on. But that took a sudden shock. I was expelled from school. My parents had divorced, and I was in Memphis that year. And I was expelled for having too much fun, I think, in class at the teacher's expense.
That brought Shelby Tucker face-to-face with what proved to be a motivating challenge, passing the entrance exam for his next school, Phillips Academy at Andover, Massachusetts.
For the first time in my life, I worked for in sort of what we call classroom or so, homework type work, and instead of playing football, etc. For the very first time, but the motive wasn't to get into Andover. The motive was to show those Yankees how much more intelligent we were down south.
Despite posting what the headmaster later described as the lowest score ever for someone we actually admitted, Shelby Tucker did get into Andover.
That year at Andover, which really was competitive, you had to read. That completely transformed me. I saw that reading was fun, and academia sort of reading and debating what you'd read, and it was education in the correct sense of the word, educare from the Latin, to bring one, to lead one out of. It was an expansion of one's world, And that completely turned me around. And today, of that particular class at Andover, I'm the only writer of books.
Shelby Tucker went on to Yale for a couple of years, then Oxford and Tulane, earning a degree in law from each. He also developed a real taste for travel, hitchhiking all around the American West and Mexico the summer before Andover, and all over Europe the next summer.
Once I'd had that experience, I mean, there was, you know, I had this disease of hoboing. I mean, it was such a rich experience. And even today, I mean, last year I was hitchhiking in India in connection with my current book. But because it was such so much more intense way of traveling, I spent my life hitchhiking.
And it was the quality of Shelby Tucker's travel experiences that ultimately led him to write.
I will write about an experience when the experience itself suggests that it's interesting and rewarding enough to impart to others. And so that that happened when I wrote Among Insurgents Walking Through Burma. I trekked from China to India through northern Burma. And I didn't do that in order to write a book. But by the time I'd done that, I had to write a book about it.
Tucker chose fiction and the novel as the best form for writing about his experiences with his brother traveling the world in the 1960s to sell mutual funds for Bernie Kornfeld's Investors Overseas Services, which the Times of London ultimately exposed as a fraud.
The salesmen, such as my brother and myself, we were victims as everyone else. We didn't know it was crooked, but we wouldn't have done it. Most of us wouldn't have done it anyway. But when the Sunday Times exposed this, of course, the stock went to nothing. And so I watched my fortune evaporate. But it gave me a great adventure. It took me out to Saudi Arabia. It took me out through Iran and Afghanistan, Pakistan and India, lots of places. I sold his mutual funds. And it gave me a great adventure, and it gave me the terrific amount of fun of writing Client Service, which is a satire. It's not a solemn book at all.
Writer Shelby Tucker, his fourth book and debut novel, Client Service, is just out in the U.S. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
Shelby Tucker will discuss and sign copies of Client Service this evening from 5:30 until 7 at the Garden District Bookshop. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm your host, Diane Mack. A blighted middle school in Treme could soon be transformed into live and work studios for local artist. Writer Ian McNulty, who produces WWNO's Community Impact Series, explores ArtSpace and its plans for the old Bell School campus.
The campus of the old Andrew J. Bell Middle School sprawls over two blocks of the Treme neighborhood in New Orleans, with six buildings, including an ornately detailed Gothic-style main building. This school was once a centerpiece of its community, though it has sat empty since Hurricane Katrina, its roof in tatters, its legacy on hold. To passersby, it looks like another sad representative of the blight epidemic around New Orleans. But Joe Butler sees something different in the bones of the old Bell campus buildings.
Large windows, big rooms, great light, large common areas. These are all things which help buildings become more community-centric in their design and in their practicality. And it's important that, one, we preserve these physical buildings, but even more importantly, we preserve the spirit and the culture and the tradition of education and community that these buildings anchor.
Butler is the local manager for a nonprofit setting out to do just that at the Bell School campus. His group is called ArtSpace, and it's a national leader in real estate development for the arts, building and managing affordable apartments and venues for artists and arts organizations. In New Orleans, ArtSpace has a plan to turn the empty Bell School campus into a new, multifaceted arts facility in the heart of its historic neighborhood, one with more than 70 studio apartments for artists to live and work, and space for arts organizations, performance venues, and community programs.
We don't have any buildings that are not regularly programmed with community activities, art walks, art crawls, art classes. We do community programming in our common rooms. The whole ethos of ArtSpace beyond artists is to really celebrate the cultural value of our neighborhoods and individuals.
While the plan is tailored to the Bell School campus and the Treme neighborhood, it shares an aim of ArtSpace projects across the country. How to create an enduring home for artists and culture bearers in areas that they have, through their work, made more attractive, more marketable, and ultimately more expensive.
I think it's fair to say that artists have influenced how neighborhoods have developed and influenced the real estate market, but very rarely been in control of the real estate they've been influencing. ArtSpace is a very unique model, and I think it gives us an opportunity to fuse things which are often thought of as opposite, because what ArtSpace does is we're a fusion of the whimsical reality of arts, but in context of what it takes to do real estate.
The plan and its financing are coming together as ArtSpace continues to build partnerships with local arts groups and community leaders. Butler expects construction to begin in 2013. The hope is that this work will bring an important community asset back to life, and in a neighborhood seeing tremendous changes, to provide an anchor for the arts and culture that has for so long been part of its identity.
They require artistic infrastructure and buildings and spaces and affordability. And our objective is to really be attentive to what the Treme community needs and perform that role as yet one more piece to help that community remain strong.
Learn more about ArtSpace at WWNO.org. For WWNO, I'm Ian McNulty.
New acquisitions at the historic New Orleans collection bring to light some obscure stories of Louisiana history. What you may find surprising in the exhibit, Something Old, Something New, is the trough of rich cultural stories found in ordinary, everyday items.
It's a chance for us at the Historic New Orleans Collection to show off some of the items that have come into the collection since 2000.
Co-curator Amanda McPhillan is excited by the artifacts that have come to the Historic New Orleans Collection over the past 12 years, either by donation or purchase. Items ranging from the everyday to the exotic that have a Louisiana backstory. The items are old but new to the collection, hence the name Something Old, Something New, and many have never been on display. For example, a simple fork and spoon are elevated to objects of interest.
If you take a closer look at them, you'll see on the handle they have the name SS New York engraved on them. This fork and the spoon were a part of a set on board the steamship New York. The steamship New York was a boat that sailed from New Orleans to Galveston back and forth on a regular route in the early 19th century. In 1846, it was sailing to New Orleans. When it sailed directly into the path of a hurricane, it was blown to pieces and sank. Luckily, most of the crew and passengers actually survived by clinging to debris until they were rescued by a boat passing by the next day. Now, the wreck would have probably completely vanished from history, except for the fact that there was a small newspaper report about the accident and the wreck. It mentioned that on board the ship was a safe that had about $30,000 in gold and silver coin in it. And so in the mid-1990s, an amateur treasure hunter from New Iberia came across this newspaper article in the archives. He decided that he was going to go find this wreckage. He spent over the next 10 years looking for it. He eventually did find it and managed to salvage most of it. And we didn't get any of the gold or silver coin, but we did get the fork and the spoon. And so for me, it's something, it's a very ordinary object. But when you look at the backstory, it really brings this moment to life.
McPhillan says one of the most spectacular pieces in the exhibit is a circa 1840 portrait titled Creole in a Red Headdress.
Painted by a Belgian-born portrait painter named Jacques Amans. He came to New Orleans about 1820, stayed here for about 30 years, painted this portrait during the course of his career here. We have no idea who the sitter is. It is a mystery. It's a very beautiful sitter. She has a red turban on. She has a white shirt with a sleeve falling off. The only clue to her identity is initials ED on the sleeve. It's just a captivating, very personal portrait. And we're hoping that in the next few years, maybe we'll be able to uncover the identity of the sitter and learn more about her.
There are more mysteries to uncover as you search through treasures from the past. Who knew sheet music would reveal this bizarre story?
A sheet of song music in the collection, and it's called the Axeman Jazz. In 1918 to 1919, there was a serial killer here in New Orleans in the French Quarter who was, as the name Axeman goes, was attacking people with an axe. And it was a very scary time here, obviously. And then this really kind of odd incident happened where there was an anonymous letter written to the Times-Picayune that warned that the Axeman was going to attack again the following evening unless there was houses playing jazz music. The Axeman was very fond of jazz, and you know, he would stay away from houses that were playing jazz music. This is probably a hoax, but it certainly caused a lot of people to have jazz parties and play a lot of jazz music the next night just to make sure that this wouldn't happen. And because of that, a local composer, Joseph John DeVia, composed this sheet music called the Axeman Jazz, commemorating this incident.
You never know what stories may creep up from the past. The diversity of our state's rich culture is told through items ranging from photographs, jazz records, portraits, letters, journals, pottery, and scrapbooks. In the exhibit, Something Old, Something New, Collecting in the 21st Century. On view at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street through February 8, 2013. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. New Orleans jazz vocalist Stephanie Jordan will join a star-studded lineup of New Orleans musicians in a benefit concert tonight at 7 at the Mahalia Jackson Theater to raise funds for victims of Hurricane Sandy. The lineup includes Marlon Jordan, Dumpster Funk, Kermit Ruffins, Irvin Mayfield, Big Sam's Funky Nation, George Porter Jr., Amanda Shaw, Big Chief Monk Boudreau, Big Chief Bo Dallas Jr., the Stephanie Jordan Ensemble, Terrence Higgins, Dirty Dozen Brass Band, Mia Borders, Corey Henry, James Andrews, The Stooges Brass Band, Chris Royal, and Sasha Masakowski. The NOLA Pay It Forward concert is organized by Mayor Mitch Landrieu as a means of returning the favor to the East Coast for their efforts in helping New Orleans recover from the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina. The Canal Street Lighting Ceremony, presented by the Downtown Development District and the Astor Crown Plaza, takes place this evening at 5:30. You can stroll Canal Street and watch as the switch is flipped, turning on more than 1 million twinkling lights. It takes place in front of the Astor Crown Plaza. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. Wishing you and yours the joy of Thanksgiving. I'm Diane Mack.